Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Dead Rock Stars with Mick Wall and Joel McIver.
Welcome, everyone. Here we go. Once more, a fantastic episode of Dead Rock Stars. I'm here with my dear friend, Mick Wall. My name is Joel McIver, and today we are going to be talking about the long-lost Kurt Cobain, are we not?
We are.
Shuffled off in 1994 in entirely tragic circumstances.
Yeah, I'm not so sure if he shuffled off so much as blew up.
Right, nicely put. Listeners, this is going to be an interesting, but I imagine fairly depressing podcast.
No, we're not going to be depressed. No.
We look at the positivity, we stay upbeat, we look at the good things.
We're going to give it a go.
We look at the bad things. Right, now, Nirvana. Okay, I'll just pitch right in. When Smells Like Teen Spirit blew up.
Yeah.
What was the phrase? Burst onto the scene, he said last time. When punk exploded onto the scene. When grunge exploded onto the scene. Well, in Nirvana's case, it would have been 1991 with the Nevermind album and the Smells Like Teen Spirit single, although they'd been around for a good few years before that.
Mm.
I was 20, so perfect kind of, you know, student-y, giddy, well, ready for this.
This is interesting. So you were 20 when Nirvana exploded onto the scene. So as a 20-year-old guy, at a time when grunge exploded onto the scene, were you a grunge fan or were you one of those kind of metalheads that were like,
it's rubbish.
What the hell is this, man? I listen to Metallica.
They can't even play their instruments.
No, these were decent musicians. Look, I was very much a Metallica and Slayer guy, as well as all the other stuff that I listened to that wasn't metal. So my brain was open. You know, it was a great time to be a young person into music, actually, the turn of the 80s to the 90s, because there was so much change going on, you know, as we'll come to. All right, so I remember sitting in, I think it was in Austria for some reason, I saw a video of Smells Like Teen Spirit. I didn't really think that much of it. I still don't think Smells Like Teen Spirit is that amazing a song. Nirvana did many, many better songs, if you ask me.
Do they?
Well,
name one.
Your eyebrow is
name
up.
Name one.
Territorial Pissings, On a Plane, Lithium, Rape Me, Penny Royalty.
Nah.
You disagree?
Rubbish.
Which is your favourite Nirvana song?
Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Really?
Nah, not really, but it's certainly one of them. I think it's a fantastic song.
Yeah.
I think Smells Like Teen Spirit, it's like saying Deep Purple had a lot better songs than Smoke on the Water. That may be true.
Yeah.
Nevertheless.
Yes, okay.
It's one of those. It's the All Right Now of the grunge scene.
Right.
It's the Whole Lot of Love of the grunge
scene.
It's the Anarchy in the UK of the grunge scene.
Yeah.
It's the...
Hit Me One More Time by Britney Spears?
Of the grunge scene. It is the Her Name is Rio. And she...
Dances on the Sand. I used to love Duran Duran. All right,
You loved Duran Duran, you didn't like Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Well, no, I did. I thought it was all right. I was intrigued by this band, and then subsequently the grunge gates opened, exploded onto the scene. And Nirvana was suddenly all over the place in a way that was kind of interesting and intriguing. I listened to them on and off the next few years. They obviously didn't have a very long lifespan after that point, only 3 years, in fact. But what's more interesting to me than just the tale of Nirvana is the masses of bands that followed in their wake, right? So Pearl Jam being the obvious big one, Soundgarden, Alice in Chains, all those amazing bands, some of which are still going, some of which are not, many of whom met with, you know, tragic ends way before their time, and no doubt we will talk about.
All of them had people that we'll be featuring in future episodes.
Absolutely.
Staley, yeah. Chris Cornell.
Yeah.
In the case of Pearl Jam, they wouldn't exist at all if Andy Ward from Mother Love Bone hadn't died.
Yeah. Now, you were a renowned journo, the star of Kerrang! Magazine in 1991-92. It all started to change. The metal of the hair went away. Suddenly, you couldn't have a mullet anymore, Mick, which I know was tragic for you. Did you buy yourself a plaid shirt?
I remember sitting in a... When I lived in LA, I was involved in what was billed as the world's first video magazine.
God damn, some video, man. It's the future. It's a magazine, but it's also a video. It's wait. A video, but it's also a magazine.
Dude, wait, you don't read it like a magazine. You put it in your video player.
And, dude, you don't look at it like a video because you can read this shit,
well,
too.
Dude, it's like the future just arrived.
And you know what it was called? It was inspirationally titled Hard and Heavy.
Wait, was it Hard?
It was hard with a lightning bolt over the un. Hard heavy.
Like
hard
Guns and heavy. Like Guns Roses.
Except they didn't have a lightning bolt over the un. See, they missed the trick there completely. So
were you working on this mag then, Hard?
I was the bleeding editor in LA, being paid a load of money to produce this awful shite once a month. But so we're in this conference room, very LA, in a lawyer's office, and planning the next two or three episodes. And it was all based in LA because that was the epicenter of rock and metal.
LA, man.
Yeah, we're in LA.
I mean, I remember filming segments with Phil Soussan from Ozzy's band.
Of course, man.
And the singer from White Lion, Mike Tramp. Mike Tramp. And they were on Harley Davidson's.
Yeah, man. I just rolled in on my bike.
And they came in together on their bikes. I had to go, hey, dudes. Sweet ride.
Was there any suggestion that the show should be moved from LA to Peterborough?
Briefly.
For a little more authentic.
Briefly, before we obviously shot him through the head. But here's what did happen. We were sitting in this big conference room with, you know, incredibly attractive secretaries bringing, you know, coffee with a thin skein of goat's udder. And
sounds like a band.
Yeah, half caffeine, half not, please, with a twist of lemon and a skein of goat's
sounds
udder.
Sounds like a Stone Temple Pilots album.
And I remember one of the young guns, one of the guys we'd brought in, a young stringer, planning this thing, and it's, well, you know, Motley are going to be doing some stuff, you know.
Man.
You know, Guns are on tour, you know.
Yeah.
Bon Jovi are coming. And one of them said, you know, there's this whole scene emerging. He didn't say that it was about to burst onto the scene. He was saying it was percolating.
Oh, nice.
And I said, where? You know, he went, oh, it was Seattle. And I think we literally all just laughed like hyenas.
So what is the cultural significance of Seattle? Back then, what was it? Was it like Slough?
Well, at the time, no, far from that. More like Islington or West Hampstead you know, Nouveau Camden. That moment, though, when he said there's this whole... This was early 91, and Seattle was known primarily for Queensryche.
And Hendrix.
Hendrix before that, yeah, but at that time, Queensryche, they were big.
They were a big band, weren't they? They had two or three big arms in a row.
Operation Mindcrime.
Empire.
Empire was the follow up in 1990, I think.
Yeah, like that.
They were huge. They were a great band. I like them. But that was it, really. You know, there's this scene percolating. It just sounded ridiculous, you know.
Had, Mudhoney and Tad and the Melvins made any impact on you before that?
No, I hadn't even heard of them. These guys were making a big impact on the NME. Mm,
yeah.
I say big impact. I mean, you know, no more so than any other independent label releases. They were considered, you know, far out and cool, but they didn't sell any records. There wasn't any video on MTV.
Yeah.
And within 8 months of that conversation, Nirvana released their big breakthrough album, Nevermind. And things definitely were about to change. People forget that actually as Nirvana were releasing Nevermind, Guns N' Roses... same month, released double albums simultaneously, Use Your Illusion 1 and 2.
Unbelievable records. I remember.
Both of which sold over 7 million copies each in America.
Beggar's belief now, right? And then the Black Album by Metallica came out around the same time. August 91, that was the Black Album.
But Nirvana were the ones that, you know, everybody predicted big things for the next Metallica album, the next Guns N' Roses album.
Yep.
Never mind... And Nirvana, outside of, you know, this percolating scene, no one knew who they were. No one was, even Nirvana's small band of staunch supporters were predicting that their album would go to number one in America, sell 10 million copies and change the course of music
history.
Dead rock stars. Too much fucking perspective.
Right, now this took us all by surprise, didn't it, right? No one saw this coming, which is unusual.
Well, by the time you get to January 1992, when Nevermind goes to number one for the first time in America, they're actually replacing, I think, whatever the latest Michael Jackson album was.
Yeah.
The Guns N' Roses albums are still around, but no one's talking about them like they're talking about Nevermind.
Mm.
And suddenly this young guy, who a year before had been trying to tip us off to what was going on, was proved extraordinarily correct, because you get the release of the first Pearl Jam album.
Mm.
You get the release, not of the first Soundgarden album, but the first big breakthrough Soundgarden album,
yes.
Bad Motor Finger. You get Alice in Chains about to release their enormous breakthrough album.
Mm, mm.
And then in their slipstream, the Mud Honeys and the Tads. Mm,
mm, mm. All the Riot Girl stuff.
All the Riot Girl stuff. Mm. L7, you know, all this stuff starts to explode onto the scene.
It's funny, you know, as a professional hack for many years now, I always tend to write things like, yes, there was this explosion of alternative rock and grunge, which led directly to funk metal and rap metal in the form of Korn, which led to nu metal, and then, of course, into the, you know, the wider scene that we know and love today. And it's also very easy from this point of view to draw the big picture, which is what we love doing. At the time, however, holy crap, it was just this giant, like, tidal wave of differentness, right, that no one could really figure out.
Yeah, in terms of the funk thing, you know, that had come before grunge.
This is my sweet spot, so let me take over, if you don't mind. You had Living Colour. You should see Mick's face. You had Living Colour.
Sorry,
the Chili Peppers.
How old were you at the time?
You had the Chili Peppers, you had Living Colour, amazing bands, right? You had 24/7 Spies. You had all this amazing funk metal stuff, largely driven by a slap bass player in the band, all right? Do you know, I edit a magazine called Bass Guitar.
The band that really brought it into fashion was Faith No More.
Mm.
And I interviewed Faith No More and the Red Hot Chili Peppers and King's X, who also brought a black rock funk dynamic.
Awesome man.
But it was the Chili Peppers, really, that were the radical act. Faith No More kind of bounced off them in the same way that Pearl Jam and Soundgarden bounced off Nirvana.
Yeah.
But no, you're right. I mean, but I think the point is that it seemed, I remember thinking at the time, that the end of the 80s, early 90s was going to be a really radical moment for rock music, because it was allowing in this funk influence, but also a lot more intelligence in the lyrics, a lot more smartness, fun. You know, the Chili Peppers with their videos and with their socks on Cox photographs, it was so much more knowing and evocative than Motley Crue or holding up bottles of Jack Daniels.
There you go. Which leads us neatly, does it not, onto the persona of Kurt Cobain, right, who wrote those amazing lyrics and personified and epitomised that sort of new, different kind of rock star.
Well, yes. I mean, he certainly fitted in like that. I don't particularly think he was part of that lineage. I think he was coming from punk. I think, you know, Seattle before grunge and before Queensryche was and still remains to this day one of the heartland markets in America for heavy metal. It was one of the first places that Black Sabbath really broke through. And of course, Cobain very early on characterised Nirvana as like the Beatles meets Black Sabbath.
Right.
Which I think is actually a very, very good analogy.
Absolutely. Look at the melodies, right?
Absolutely.
You can't help seeing it burrow into your brain. Proper earworms. And yet it was pretty heavy.
Dun, 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 dun.
Right.
Yeah, it's all there, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, totally melodic. You know, pretty heavy. That's a trio as well that have a serious amount of power. Or they became a trio for Nevermind. Now, I, like so many other people, went back and discovered Bleach after Nevermind had come out and got big. And like so many other people, I just thought it didn't have the hooks and the kind of the general coolness.
Well,
a lot of people would disagree.
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't disagree with you. Bleach became a hit posthumously because you got Nevermind. Now you want to buy another one.
Yeah.
There's Bleach.
Yeah, yeah.
I think also when they did the Unplugged album, that great version of About a Girl they did, that song was on Bleach.
Yeah.
So I think Bleach had a lot of great characteristics, but it didn't have Dave Grohl and it didn't have Butch Vig.
Mm.
They brought the dynamics that I think totally opened up the Nirvana sound.
See, Kurt, at one point at least, I mean, he contradicted himself many times, but he said that he disliked the production of Nevermind. He said it was like Boston or one of those. He likened it to a kind of pop rock band.
I think he was right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, the only bit I would disagree with him on is I liked it.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, he was right, but Butch Vig did what he was hired to do, which was take this raggle-taggle, punk, new wave Seattle, it always rains indoors in Seattle, I want to kill myself, and actually turned it into commercial gold. Mm. I mean, I don't think they sold out, as it were.
No, I think
they made a fantastic record.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's okay, so... No, I was going to jump forward to In Utero, but I will not, because we always fucking do this, or I always do this. Okay, cool. Let's talk a little bit about Kurt then. He famously was public about the troubled background that he'd had. It very quickly went on the record and remains on the record now, not least because there are a couple of really good books about Nirvana. But he talked, did he not, in the spirit of the times, very openly to the papers, The Enemy Exactly, as you mentioned before, who espoused grunge from an early point, about the troubled life he'd had, his family background, the divorce of his parents when he was 9, the sort of hyperactivity he'd suffered, the weird religious stuff.
Well, here we go again with the tortured life of a genuine musical genius.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, he
it's sad.
Sad, but true. As I always come back to this point, sad on a personal level, but look what we got at the end of it. I mean, that's not to say every poor person that ends up on the street is going to produce a Nevermind.
Yeah.
Clearly, that's not the case.
Right. Mm-hmm.
At the same time, the fact is this exceedingly talented, sensitive, artistic young man used this background, this really difficult background, where, you know, he's living at different people's houses. Mm, at one point, he's living under a bridge.
Yeah.
You know, by
that
the
was disputed, by the way.
Well, the
legend has grown, you know what I mean? People say, oh, he lived under a bridge.
Okay, well, you need to elucidate here, because I don't
know what
you mean.
Born of the Melvins said, no, that's bullshit, he never lived under a bridge.
Well, no one believes a fucking word he says. So let's never mention him again, okay?
No, you have to mention the Melvins, of course, because they were such a massive influence on Nirvana.
Well, they were. How many of their songs would you name?
Oh, many, many, none. I've interviewed Buzz, actually. I still can't you know, name any of their songs. I'm sure they're very special.
No, I don't mean to be dismissive of Buzz or the Melvins, but fuck it. You know, he lived under a fucking bridge.
Under a bridge.
Fuck you, Buzz. You didn't live under the bridge. I was there that night. Not you.
Did you? No, I did. All right, look.
So let me finish. He lived under a fucking bridge and he wrote a song about it early on called Smells Like a Fucking Bridge. And then Butch Vig, Buzz as he was known, turned that into a pop song called Smells Like Teen Spirit. Kurt Cobain was a very troubled young man. So was David Bowie, you know. So was Prince. Mm. So was...
James Hetfield.
Sandy Denny. Well, James is still alive, you know.
Oh, yeah, I see. They're all dead, the previous ones. Yeah,
I mean, you know, lots of great artists. John Lennon, Jim Morrison. Mm. You know, they led really troubled lives. That's part of why they go on to become artists.
Mm, that's quite right.
If they'd come from comfortable, well-adjusted families, they would have gone on and worked in Silicon Valley and been zillionaires.
Very good point. Well made, Mick. Okay, cool. So this album came about unexpectedly, really. They'd been signed to Sub Pop, right?
They'd been signed to Sub Pop, and the usual suspects had become interested. Mm. John Peel did a session, The Enemy wrote about them. But the significance of Kurt Cobain's life isn't about that period. It's about what happens after the success.
How he reacted to it,
How he reacted to it, how the world reacted to it. And I think probably for the last time in living rock history memory, we actually had a new artist come along that effected a ground zero.
Yeah, right.
You know, so suddenly Motley Crue, Guns N' Roses, Bon Jovi, Def Leppard, Whitesnake, that entire echelon of huge rock artists from just before Nirvana suddenly are not only obsolete, they look stupid, they look silly.
They really did, didn't they?
They really, really did.
Pouting, preening cockerels of rock.
They did. But my issue with the Pearl Jams and the Soundgardens is more to do with the fact that they, you know, I think Kurt Cobain couldn't help be anything but himself.
Mm.
I know, I'm fully confident that he wanted to be a star, no matter what he said.
Yeah.
Of course he did. Mm. But Pearl Jam saw what was going on and did something about it. Soundgarden saw what was going on and did something about it. And more, you know, kudos to them for doing so.
Yeah.
But Soundgarden on their previous albums, it sounded like Led Zeppelin.
Mm.
Jeff Ament, the bass player in Pearl Jam, was an Iron Maiden fanatic. Mm. Andrew Wood in Mother Love Bone loved Freddie Mercury and Queen. You know, these weren't grungy, gloomy, I hate myself, I want to die Kurt Cobain disciples.
Lane Staley had been in an early version of Alice in Chains, which was a glam band.
Well, there you go.
That's where you got their name from.
So I think the grunge scene, as it became known, quickly became characterised with this very gloomy...
Right, sort of emotionally literate kind of thing, in a way that the Motley Crues had not been.
Yeah.
So, again, I referred to this earlier, but, you know, you look at Kurt plunging his whole self into his lyrics in a very sort of confessional way. You know, you could successfully argue that that went into Pearl Jam and it went into Korn and it went in later into Slipknot, and it became a thing for people to play very heavy, aggressive music, but to put a sort of very sensitive, delicate emotions into their music. And perhaps that hadn't really happened in metal, it had happened elsewhere, but perhaps it really hadn't happened in hard rock and metal before Kurt.
Well, hard rock and metal had become very mannered by the time Nirvana come along.
That's a good point. I mean, just stale sort of thing?
Formulaic.
Yeah, yeah.
It was much more about 15-year-old boys throwing the devil horns. Guns N' Roses introduced sensitivity. You know, Sweet Child of Mine.
Mm. Think about you.
It's not a coincidence that that album sold to far more people than just hard rock and heavy metal fans. But if you go back to Led Zeppelin and Deep Purple and Black Sabbath and Thin Lizzy, Queen, all these bands had wonderful ballads and melodic tunes.
Yeah.
But it kind of got washed away because the 80s became about niche. The 80s, you know, Kerrang! Magazine wouldn't have stood a chance in the 70s because people wouldn't understand why you could only like Iron Maiden, but you couldn't like Sparks or Cockney Rebel.
Right, right.
But Nirvana comes along, Kurt Cobain comes along. And I think what you were alluding to earlier is absolutely correct, which is the success and this whole thing about being a spokesman for a generation.
Right. What a terrible thing to be saddled with.
That happened a lot in the 60s. Townsend, Dylan. Morrison. Dylan was the big one.
Yeah, yeah.
And then with punk, Johnny Rotten. You know, a lot of these guys had come before, but suddenly Kurt Cobain is another one. It appalls him, terrifies him, doesn't know what to do with it. And while he's still thinking about it, hooks up with the modern Yoko Ono, Courtney Love.
Mm, and resorts to drugs significantly.
Well, heroin was a big, big part of the Seattle scene, as it were.
Yeah.
I mean, we should talk about Seattle. Seattle, in case people don't know, very European. Mm. It's not California with the sunshine. It's not New York with the edge.
Mm-hmm.
It was very suburban, very poor, a lot of it. The climate not great, more like Ireland. California, raining all the time.
Mm.
And as I was saying to you earlier, in those days, there wasn't a very big live scene in Seattle. So the weird part of that was that all these bands would rehearse and rehearse and rehearse, rather than most bands form, and as soon as they can play a song, they're doing a gig, you know. These guys didn't really do many gigs, but boy, did they get good at their instruments. So you've suddenly got Kurt, who embodies this sort of punk spirit, but at a time when he's got one of the best drummers in the world in the band. And Soundgarden, brilliant musicians. Mm. Pearl Jam, that 10 album.
Yeah.
If 10 had come out in 1972, they'd have been compared to Free or Led Zeppelin, you know. So it's this weird mixture of this punk spirit, as it were, but this real heavy metal pride in being able to play well.
And it hit the spot, the popular spot, the commercial spot. People loved it in their millions.
Although, you know, to this day, a lot of metal people feel very aggrieved.
Conflicted. Oh, man. Right. So, as a 20-year-old thrash metal fan, when all this stuff came out in 91, 92, Metallica released the Black Album, which was not a thrash metal album. I was one of those kids. Oh, what's weird? What are they doing? Oh, no, it's not metal. It's not metal. You can't like this, all that bollocks.
Is that what you said about the Black Album?
Pretty much.
Really?
Yeah, I still don't really play it, like, compared to the earlier stuff.
So how did you go with Load?
Oh, I hated Load.
You must have, like, wanted to kill yourself.
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
Did you get a shotgun?
I despised it. I thought there's one good song on Load and one on Reload, and then
Was the good song on Load Fuel?
Yeah. You know me so well. You know what you're saying about Seattle?
Yeah.
Duff McKagan's from Seattle. And he had to move down to LA, didn't he, to make it?
Well, he was a punk.
Yeah.
And you couldn't get many gigs because there weren't many gigs.
No.
He was in 10 Minute Warning and various other small-time bands.
Yeah, yeah.
So he wants to make it as a musician. He moves to LA, goes down the coast.
Talk about making it, yeah.
But then, you know, in this country, you know, I'm not putting down any particular town, but say you happen to live in Doncaster.
Oh, that's where I live, you bastard.
Or West Bromwich.
No, I've got a second half there.
Actually, West Bromwich isn't a good example because of Robert Palmer.
Well, Ian, the producer, lives there. He's got a mansion there.
Yeah. Well, see, now, there you go. Now, he's a talented guy. He obviously moved to London to make it. And when that didn't work out.
So what does it take when you're to handle the label spokesman for a generation?
I think in the 60s it was a cross to be nailed to.
Yeah.
But everything was so new that perhaps there was a possibility of some kind of, you know, like look at the John Lennon, what he did with that whole mantle. He actually did try and take it somewhere in terms of world peace. I think Kurt Cobain went home, stuck a needle in his arm and was like, "What world, go away. World, you know, shut your mouth."
Well, shut your mouth, yeah. You know, it's funny, I was reading about this. He had all these stomach pains, which are classically a sort of lost child sort of thing. But they're also, you know, have you ever known anyone with Crohn's disease?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, that is no joke. And I wonder whether something like, he had something like that was undiagnosed, took to the smack as a very powerful painkiller to get rid of all that, got hooked, and then his trajectory went down from there. And trying to deal with this pressure to be, you know, the leader of Nirvana, you can see it in Utero, which I liked. Did you enjoy that record?
It took me a long time to listen to it and know what I was listening to.
Get a reference, yeah.
I remember reviewing that record and being completely flummoxed. Right now, I mean, of course, soon after, it all made sense to me.
Yeah.
But in some ways, that was the real follow-up to Bleach.
Right, yeah. OK, it's lo-fi. You got Steve Albini producing, right?
Who basically, Steve Albini comes in, presses record and retreats. You know, let's be honest.
The Rick Rubin of grunge.
Well, Rick Rubin actually does lay a sound and comes up with something good.
No, I liked that album. I thought, okay, I get this now. Where Nevermind had been quite bright and shiny, you know, and in your face and lots of chart hits aiming to please everyone. Yeah. This one was not trying to please anyone.
But themselves.
Yeah, it still sold giant amounts of units, of course.
Interesting. I mean, the riff to Rape Me was pretty much Smells Like Teen Spirit.
All right, yeah, there was a lot of...
Except the real, you know, Kurt going, well, you know, I'll show you what I really meant.
Yeah.
But what a great song.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, man. You know, and look at the rest of the band. You mentioned Grohl earlier. Jesus Christ, man. I mean, as we now know, 20 years later, the man is a force of nature. You know, he dominates every single thing he does in a brilliant way. Back then, he was just the drummer. He didn't write any of the songs, did he? I think it was all Kurt.
No, he didn't. Although, towards the end of Kurt's life, Dave was writing songs.
Yeah, for a putative next album.
I think just writing songs, really. And the Foo Fighters didn't exist until way after Kurt was dead. No, just starting to write songs. Mm-hmm. Simple as that, really. Mm-hmm. Kurt talked about one or two in interviews that they were going to make. I think they did one as a B-side or something. You know, it was just starting to come in a
nodding,
little bit.
So you're okay.
Yeah. I think we should swap seats because you're always looking at the producer. Stop talking about
the.
If the producer nods, that means it's okay.
I can look at you and look at him. He's much better looking.
Well, I don't. I dispute that fact. I don't disagree.
Put it out on the wire.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Dead Rock Stars with Mick Wall and Joel McIver.
All right, cool. So I read an interview with Michael Stipe not long ago, of REM, of course, and he said that they were all set to start demoing the next Nirvana album to come out in whatever, 95. It was going to be an acoustic record with strings.
Mm.
That may be incredibly common knowledge, it wasn't to me. And I'm trying to think, well, would that have worked? Would it have really happened? Would the record company have allowed it to happen? Would people have bought it? Would it have been the end of Nirvana? Where do you stand on this, Mick Wall?
I say no to all those things. Mm. You only got to look at the success of the Unplugged album.
Yeah.
To see that anything Kurt Cobain did would have been seized upon, loved, adored. Yeah. I mean, it might have been that the hardcore Alice in Chains fans and Soundgarden rockers may have not enjoyed it as much.
Yeah.
But I don't think it would have been the end of Nirvana.
They already had three pretty heavy albums out.
And it might have been the making of them. I mean, sure. One of the things that, you know, Metallica, for instance, have railed against over the years and paid the price for, I think, is trying to break the mould, whether it's doing an orchestral album, doing St. Anger, where they try for a more avant-garde kind of sound. Mm. You know, Nirvana did In Utero, and the critics just wet themselves. And
it's, no, I remember it was nauseating.
With glee.
Yeah, yeah.
Metallica do St. Anger, and to this day, they still get kicked in the arse over it because they dared try to do something that was more interesting than what people were expecting. Metallica do something with Lou Reed, and it stinks out the room as far as their fans are concerned. You know, Led Zeppelin, one of the reasons, arguably, they had a much bigger career than Black Sabbath or Deep Purple was that they changed each album.
Yeah.
You know, that third album was not what the record company wanted.
Yeah.
It was not what the fans wanted. Was actually the worst selling of all the Led Zeppelin albums, although it did still sell extremely well. Because it was mainly acoustic, because it was a little offbeat. But arguably, it's because they did those things that their career lasted longer, because it wasn't a case of ever diminishing returns. I mean, I love Iron Maiden, but I don't see anything particularly surprising about the albums they've made over the last 20 years or so.
No.
They get better and better at what they do, arguably, but it's still the same thing.
Right.
And Nirvana just weren't of that mould. And Kurt Cobain loved acoustic music. He loved... I mean, you've only got to look at some of the choices on The Unplugged, you know, the Meat Puppets tracks.
Yeah, there's a Bowie track on there.
Man Who Sold the World, About a Girl.
Penny Royalty.
Absolutely. And these were really beautiful versions.
Yeah.
Grohl on brushes on some of it, you know.
And actually, we should remember Krist Novoselic as well.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what he achieved in Nirvana other than be the tall, funny bass player, you know, who threw his bass in the air, hit him on the head at an MTV Awards show, which is absolutely brilliant. He told me once when I interviewed him that he threw the bass in the air, got caught in the lighting rig, hung there for a few seconds while he sort of tried to, we lurched about wondering if it was going to come down. It did come down. You know, these things weigh 5 kilos. It smacked him on the forehead.
He's lucky he didn't get killed.
He could have got killed. And so he staggered off with blood pissing out of his forehead, only to find Brian May offering him a glass of champagne backstage, which I always thought was a wonderful anecdote.
Now, here's a question. When Kurt committed suicide, which we must talk about.
Of course.
That was the end of Nirvana. What if Krist Novoselic had been killed by that bass guitar landing on his head? Would that have been the end of Nirvana?
I would doubt it. I don't think he was the person people were looking at.
They'd have probably just got Dave Ellefson in.
It wouldn't have been... I know where you're going with that, but no, it wouldn't have been Ellefson, obviously. It would have been someone like the bass player from Mudhoney, or it would have been Kathleen Hanna.
Kathleen Hanna, good call.
Bikini Kill, right? Yeah. Or I tell you who it would have been. What's that amazing woman? Melissa Auf der Mauer.
Yeah.
Incredible bass player, super cool musician. Yeah. Someone like that, they would have just roared forward. And it's interesting to me, while we're talking about the other members of Nirvana, that Grohl flowered so incredibly into this sort of every man of rock. You know, he does everything, he achieves everything, the music's great.
I wrote a book on the Foo Fighters, and you can't tell Grohl's story without telling Kurt's story to a degree. And to me, they were sort of yin and yang. They were different sides of the coin, where Kurt really, really had huge difficulty in embracing pop stardom or being populist in any way. You know, he used to hate it, he said, when people turned up at their shows in Guns N' Roses T-shirts.
We'll talk about GNR, because they had a whole thing, didn't they?
It really upset him.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas Dave Grohl, as you say, every man, I mean, he's happy for anybody. He's happy for mum and dad to turn up.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, his mum does turn up at a lot of his shows,
That's great.
He's got this big smile.
Yeah.
Kurt would smile, but no one remembers that, do they?
Kurt was damaged. I guess that's what it is, right?
You know,
Grohl was not. Talking of Guns N' Roses, I recently found out, or this is probably common knowledge to everyone else, that when Metallica, Guns N' Roses did that giant tour, must have been the biggest of that couple of years, with Faith No More in support, that originally Metallica wanted Nirvana to open the show. Mm. Which is interesting to me because I would think pretty soon into that tour, Nirvana were as big as those other two bands, pretty much, right? And yet Kurt didn't want to do it, and Lars Ulrich, who wrote about it a few years later, surmised that it was because he didn't want to be on the same stage as Axl Rose, with whom he'd had a falling out of sorts. There's a brilliant story, which I'm sure you'll tell much better than me. Doesn't it go along the lines of they're walking down a backstage corridor or something? It's Kurt and Courtney and Axl. Do you know the story?
It was actually at the MTV Music Awards.
Yeah, yeah.
And Guns N' Roses and Nirvana were on the bill. And this actually happened after the Metallica and Guns N' Roses tour had happened. Mm. And Axl had actually been one of the famous people that came out early on and talked about how much he liked Nirvana.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was Axl that dragged Slash to see Nirvana play at the Palace in LA.
Yeah.
Palace is like the Camden Academy Palace, it's a stand-up club.
Yeah.
And Slash was like, whatever. Or Axl was like, they're amazing, you know.
Yeah.
And it was either at the Palace, I think it was at the Palace show, where Axl went up to Kurt and said to him, you know, I could have been you. Because Axl, of course, the supremely damaged individual from Buttsville, nowhere in America, like Kurt.
What did he mean by I could have been you?
I think, well, I could have been you. I could have been exactly like you, in a band exactly like you.
Yeah, okay.
We actually have a great deal in common.
Okay. Right.
That's what I think he was saying.
Got it.
You know, because by then he's Axl Rose. He's this megastar. And he's saying to this kid who's still partially, mostly unknown, he's saying, you know, you and me, we're like the same. We're the same.
Mm-hmm.
And Kurt was like, no, I am not like you. Because Guns N' Roses had done the One in a Million song.
Right. Politically, they were
perceived as, Axl was perceived as homophobic, as racist, as a bit of a redneck.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So, you know, Kurt took offence to that suggestion. Axl thought he was extending a wonderful compliment.
Mm.
But in the typical kind of these two really dysfunctional, fucked up people, they both took it badly. And when Nirvana made it known that they'd rather cut off their right nut, Axl took it personally, as he was right to do.
Mm.
Because Cobain would have toured with Metallica in drop of a hat.
Yeah.
Metallica were huge in Seattle. So finally then, towards the end of 92, you get the MTV Music Awards.
Yeah.
And Nirvana are on first, but they really are kind of like the opening act, even though they're big.
Yeah.
And they've got the big stage set and they've got the piano. And as they're walking off, Kurt spits on the piano because, in his mind, he knows it's Axl's piano.
Where to do November Rain.
Turns out it was Elton John's piano,
Christ,
who was also there. And anyway, they find out about this and there's this big thing. Oh, blah, blah,
dude,
blah, blah, blah.
Dude, you spit on the piano.
You fag from Seattle.
Goddamn, man.
I'm going to kick your ass.
I'm going to kick your butt.
So Guns N' Roses do their thing. And then they come off. This is where you get your backstage walking down the corridor thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Axl goes past where Courtney and Kurt's dressing room is, and Courtney's actually holding, or Kurt rather, is holding their baby.
Francis, yeah.
Francis Bean. And as he walks past with his entourage of bodyguards and yes men, Courtney goes, woo, Axl, you know, would you like to be godfather to our daughter?
Just to fuck with him.
Of course. Mm. And he comes over and he says to Kurt, tell your bitch to shut her fucking mouth or I'm going to take you down to the pavement.
Whoa.
And Kurt turns to Courtney and goes, bitch, shut your mouth.
That's making Axl look like a total Neanderthal.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So Axl storms off, you know. Then Duff, our friend from Seattle, comes back with bodyguards and decides to go in and rough them up.
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and then there's a little bit of it. It's not really, it's what we would call handbags at 10
paces. Pushing and shoving.
Yeah.
Dude, I'm going to mess you up, man. Yeah. Nobody says that to my singer. Don't believe you spat Elton's piano.
Yeah, and it wasn't even Axl's piano, it was Elton's.
Duff comes into the story a little
Sir
bit later.
Elton!
Dead Rock Stars, say hello to heaven.
Right, so Kurt suffered some issues with heroin, I believe. Fleetwood Mac, beginning of 1994,
Hang on. Let me pull you over. Kurt suffered some issue. He was a fucking junkie.
He was a junkie.
And had been for quite a few years.
He was injecting opiates into his veins. And it's not recommended under current NHS guidelines.
No.
He overdosed once on champagne and Rohypnol.
And heroin.
I shouldn't laugh, but that's like an odd combination.
Date rape.
You know what I mean? Yeah, he date raped himself. Yeah. But over that.
By the way, you say got over that. It came out that was actually the first suicide attempt.
Oh.
So it wasn't that he accidentally...
There
was a suicide... No, you stop telling him to take stuff out.
I'm saying it to wind you up.
No, you're not. You don't want to be sounding stupid.
Take this out.
Make him sound stupid in just as I sound stupid, okay?
All this. Get rid of it. Right.
Well, you're not sitting there anymore. I'm sitting there in the future.
There was that first suicide attempt. Courtney staged an intervention, I believe, after which Kurt agreed to enter rehab. Did subsequently go to rehab. However, he fled from rehab, took a taxi from the rehab facility to the airport in LA, got on a plane to Seattle, where he sat next to Duff McKagan. Duff subsequently reported that Kurt seemed on good form. I think this is something like April the 4th or April the 5th, 1994. He went back to their house, which was a Lake Wishka, I think, right? Or somewhere.
Beautiful house.
Yeah, right, yeah. Courtney went mad, obviously, with worry. Hired a private investigator to find him. This did not happen. However, a chap showed up to install a security system at their house and saw Kurt's body in or around April the 5th, 6th, 7th, 1994. He had shot himself in the head with a shotgun and he had written a lengthy suicide note directed to his imaginary friend, Bodda. So this was all April 1994. I remember very clearly I was in Australia. And it went out on the wire.
You seem to have spent... Mm. You know when grunge was exploding onto the scene? First you were in Austria, and then you're in Australia.
Yeah.
Did you at any point live in the UK?
Only countries that begin and end with... Ah. I was travelling through Australia, doing the stupid post-student thing, not redoing a thing. But I remember very clearly hearing that, sitting in, Melbourne, and I heard this, and I was, really shocked. I was like, what the hell? I couldn't remember the suicide of a prominent musician in my lifetime before that. I'm sure there were, but I can't think of any right now. I remember being horrified, genuinely shocked. And I watched the news reports of that vigil that took place where Courtney showed up, read parts of his letter and sort of swore at him in massive rage, as she was totally entitled to do. He'd left their two-year-old daughter without a father. And it was just horrible, man. And obviously that was the end of Nirvana. And there was something of a sea change. I mean... God, you were in the business at the time, my friend. You know, you saw those bands that had followed in the wake of Nirvana get bigger and bigger, and, their careers weren't affected. But that was it for Nirvana. And shocking, horrible, heroin-assisted death. And we seem to be covering these things a little bit, as we work through this series, Mick. People whose issues lead them to drugs and the drugs lead them to the end of their lives. Have we talked about someone who commits suicide yet? I don't think we have. We've talked about people who died in various circumstances, but not inflicted with a gun.
Mm.
He talked, to his credit, at length about the demons that he was facing. I think he lost all enjoyment in life. I think his words were, "I can't stand to look my daughter in the face." Everything in him must have come to a peak at that moment. The drugs, the pains, the spokesman for a generation, everything. And it didn't take long, as far as I recall, for the rumours to start flying. So several years later, Nick Broomfield did that Kurt and Courtney documentary. Previous to that, there had been that singer El Duce of the Mentors, who talked about, he out and out claimed that Courtney had...
El Duce's in the Nick Broomfield documentary, yeah.
Yeah. He out and out claimed that Courtney had hired someone to kill Kurt.
Mm.
Now, I can't remember. I haven't really gone that deeply into these conspiracy theories, but I imagine it's because why would she want to do that?
Well, let's unpack it, as they say.
Yes, mate.
Why did Kurt kill himself? I don't think we can answer that.
Yep.
Lots of people are heroin addicts. They don't shoot themselves in the head. Lots of people come from broken homes. They don't shoot themselves in the head. Lots of people become insanely famous as musicians and they don't shoot themselves in the head.
Yep.
All those things, some kind of contributory factor.
Yeah.
All of those things are some kind of contributory factor in writing a song like Rape Me.
Sure. Or Lithium.
Heart-Shaped Box. Ooh,
many of them, really.
Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Yeah.
It's inseparable from who he was. I remember at the time, though, being most puzzled. This is at the time, not now. But at the time, I was most puzzled with the idea that this millionaire 27-year-old guy who is the most famous rock pop musician in the world at this point. He's the Jesus Christ of rock at this point.
Yep.
You know, he's not just a star. He's a bigger star than Axel. He's the biggest star in music probably since John Lennon or that era.
Yeah.
And he's got a two-year-old daughter, and he shoots himself in the head. It's his second suicide attempt within a few weeks.
Mm.
Why? I couldn't understand. I mean, despite what I've just said, I still couldn't understand why he would do that. And I remember writing a piece about it, and I interviewed a private doctor here in London, a guy who specialised in working with musicians over the years. He'd worked with Keith Moon, he worked with Greg Lake, he worked with many, many people. And he said to me, it doesn't make any difference how much money someone's got or success or fame. If you've got deep, deep depression or you have deep, deep mental issues, none of those things alleviate it. He said some of the most deeply disturbed people that I treat are the most successful. So he said none of those things come into play. Whatever made him do it, the money and that was not going to persuade him otherwise. In terms of the conspiracies, again, it's very hard to unpack. I mean, El Duce, you know, he should have been called El Duce because he's just a wanker. This awful guy who no one had heard of until he started claiming Courtney had paid him to kill Kurt. Now,
he claimed that someone else had been paid to kill.
Oh, sorry, I beg your pardon.
Right.
Okay, well, why would she want Kurt killed? There was a detective that wrote a book about it as well, and he went deep into the reasons. The truth is, I don't have a strong feeling about this. I didn't read that book. A lot of this stuff is very exploitative.
Yeah.
A lot of this book is very sensationalist.
Yeah.
You know, whatever actually happened, I think the police would have seen if there were signs of murder.
I think, right?
I mean, they were first on the scene. You know, you can still see pictures online.
Yeah.
He's got a big box of hypodermic syringes and a packet of heroin there.
Yeah.
There are witnesses saying he went out looking to buy a shotgun in the days and weeks leading up to it. I don't think it's a surprise that he killed himself. I think it would be more of a surprise to learn that Courtney had decided to have him assassinated.
Yeah. I don't think anybody was surprised that he would kill himself. They go, well, that doesn't really tie in with his personality or his lyrics. Clearly it did. I think you just nailed it there. We don't know, but we wonder why. You wonder why, you know. I'm sure you know people who've killed themselves. I certainly do. You wonder why. Sometimes it's not obvious. Sometimes the mental anguish is so great that it cannot be redeemed and you can't escape it.
And there are people, I mean, you're saying that. I'm thinking of a friend of mine, a dear woman, her younger brother in his 30s hung himself from a bridge.
Jeez.
Now, he wasn't famous and he wasn't rich and he wasn't a junkie. He just had something that he could not overcome.
Yeah, and nothing else could stand against it, you know.
And I think it clouds your vision when you go, yeah, but he was Kurt Cobain, man.
Yeah, our brain chemistry is not there, so we can't really competently say what or what was not happening there. All right, do we have anything else to say about Kurt before we move to the five stars, which we traditionally award? Well, clearly we could talk about Kurt all day. It's an amazing but tragic story.
I think it's interesting that Kurt Cobain sparked, you know, we joked earlier about when it grunge exploded onto the scene. Exploded onto the scene.
Grunge, that was a shit name for music.
That was Kurt. And when grunge died, that was Kurt.
Right.
Because not entirely Kurt, but very much Kurt, because Nirvana were gone.
Mm.
No one really cared about the third or fourth Pearl Jam or Soundgarden album.
No.
Alice in Chains carried on doing some great stuff, but that vanished pretty quickly afterwards. And in this country, Oasis released their first album.
Yeah, and suddenly it was all feel-good stuff again.
Yeah.
Liam Gallagher said of Kurt, he was a sad twat who couldn't handle the fame, although he didn't use the word twat.
Liam Gallagher says a lot of things.
I think he was probably under the influence of something at the time.
Yeah, I saw a clip of him doing one of the festivals this summer. He was fucking awful. His voice has gone.
I saw it.
He's still wearing the same hoodie he was wearing 25 years ago. In your 20s, you can be a complete twat, and it's somewhat funny. But in your 40s, it's somewhat sad.
Time to move on, mate. Time to move on.
Yeah.
All right. Star quality for Kurt. How many marks out of five, stars out of five, would you give him for his star quality?
7.
He was a star. Fucking hell, man. Those photo shoots, he loved it.
Absolutely. Of course he did.
All those iconic pictures.
Absolutely.
The shades, the jumpers.
Of course.
Man,
he was
up for it. Yeah.
He was as much of an icon in the 90s as the Beatles were in the 60s.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. His influence as a songwriter, musician, perhaps a man who even took his own life.
I'm going to say 5.
There was a lot of copycat suicides, you know, right after that.
Also copycat music in his lifetime and beyond.
Oh, right, yeah. I'm thinking of, like, Bush.
Well, that's a definite copy. But, I mean, I would say Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, Alice in Chains. You know, yeah. in the same way that Joe Strummer of The Clash was in a country rock band before he saw the Sex Pistols.
You know, yeah, you're totally right.
You've all got to start somewhere. Yeah. All these bands did not become what they became when Soundgarden were releasing Louder Than Live or whatever it was called,
that's
you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or when Andrew Wood was poncing around the stage like Freddie Mercury. They were a great band, Mother Love Bone, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
But nothing to do with grunge.
Maybe grunge is really, you know, bands from a way lower level. I mean, Mudhoney is the example, isn't it? People always talk about Mudhoney, Dinosaur Jr.
But no one talked about Mudhoney until Kurt Cobain came along.
But you're quite right. Well, which really says quite a lot about his influence then, as you just said.
Yeah.
Kurt's taste for excess. Interesting, isn't it? Man, so he didn't lap up the adulation of the audience, as far as we know.
In terms of excess, man was a heroin addict. You know, so I'm going to say 5.
He's alleged to have said he wanted to develop a heroin addiction.
Well, that would fit in. I mean, here's a guy that had a collection of dolls with their heads snapped off. This was a disturbed, damaged young man who happened to be a great artist. And
it's brutal, isn't it, really?
So excess. I just think anybody that's sticking a needle in their arm and pushing heroin into their vein for many years, you know, for quite a few years, and yet has the opportunity not to be that person.
Right.
You know, excess 5, got to be.
Yeah, okay, mate. All right, then. Death as a career move. Now, this is a potentially cynical thing that we always talk about, but actually it does make a bit of sense. He was a member of the, I hate this term, the 27 Club. Mm. You know, it does exist. Mm. He died at that terribly difficult age in a person's life, especially if you're the spokesman for a generation. Mm. He's still talked about more and more and more.
James Dean.
Yeah.
Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
He's one of those. I think, unlike, say, Jim Morrison, who was so dissipated at the time of his death, it's hard to argue that he'd have gone on to greater things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Unlike Jimi Hendrix, who left behind enormous vaults worth of music, Kurt was neither of those. He doesn't appear to have left behind a great deal of music.
Mm.
But nevertheless, his legend is enshrined,
isn't it,
in this event where he kills himself. Because he was, on paper, at the pinnacle of success. Not just success, but beyond success. Mythology.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was a myth even while he was alive. And in death, of course, he's now one of the stars
in
the
sky. One of the saints. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. He is. All right. Okay, everyone. Well, thank you very much indeed for tuning in. Share the heck out of this podcast, please. We do value your opinion. Now, Mick, now you've got your reading glasses on. Could you let us know what's happening next time?
Of course. Let me just adjust my crutches. Well, both Kurt and our next Dead Rock star featured a grim irony in their songs. Kurt swore he didn't have a gun.
Yep.
When clearly he did. Okay. And ultimately, our next artist was not flying high again.
Oh.
Another grim irony, Kurt thought suicide was the solution. Our next Dead Rock star also has a connection with those words. Kurt managed just one more studio album than our next Dead Rock star, 3 against 2.
That doesn't really give it away.
This might.
Okay.
Finally, Kurt's middle initial was D. D was also a signature solo piece for our next Dead Rock star.
Oh! This has been yet another amazing production by 7 Digital. And we'll see you next week for another awesome episode of Dead Rock Stars. Thank you! Goodbye!
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of plan investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.